Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Double feature podcast that celebrates all movies from the sublime to the suspicious. As always, I'm Lindsay Wilkins, and this week might be one of the more ambitious double features we've done on the show, because we're sitting down for a double of Disney Channel's, I think I've got that right, Disney Channel's Smart House from 1999, and the monumental Stanley Kubrick joint, 2001 A Space Odyssey from 1968. And who suggested this madness, do you ask? Well, you all know him because he's the amazing host of the great Film Feast podcast. It's Matt Blitzer. Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Lindsay, how's it going? I am very excited to be back on your show. It's been too long. We were talking about it been like a few months since we talked, and that's entirely too long. So I'm very happy to be back with this insane double feature that I picked you, and almost instantly, because I'm like, what am I doing to cinema over here?
No, it has been too long, and just because conflicting things, you know, holidays, different seasons, it was just all a bit hard to get it together. But I'm finally glad we're actually sitting down now. I think when you pitched this to these two movies, I almost called it offensive, but in the best possible way. Because I'm like, what, you want to pair what with 2001, and I have to now talk about 2001? What? Which I have very mixed feelings on. But no, watching this double was absolutely fantastic. And as I think I was mentioning you before, this is the first time 2001 made any narrative sense. So I actually can tackle it from a direction, I think. So this is going to be a great show.
Okay, good. I'm glad you're excited. Because, yeah, when I pitched it, I think I even thought this might be offensive to people. If they're like, I'm going to have film Twitter coming from my head after this one, I think. But I'm not sure. I think it works in a weird way. We'll talk about it, but I'm very excited to talk about both these movies. Very different, but somehow similar. It's weird. I don't know how it's going to work, but we'll talk about it.
The essence of Schlock and Awe. Why are these two movies together? And you tend to bring these ones a lot, which I love. But before we get into it, I forgot to ask you, did you pick some trailers? Or
I did. Again, the trailers are not my, I think I said before, the trailers are not my strong suit your show. I'm very like basic with my trailer picks. I don't know why, but like, I'm so jealous people with like creative trailer picks that come on. Mine are always like very obvious, I feel like. So I don't even know who's technically even have trailers. If you want Smart House, are we doing Smart House first or 2001?
Smart House first, then 2001.
Good call. It's the lesser of the two. So Smart House is a Disney Channel original movie. So I went with two of my other favorite Disney Channel original movies. They might have commercials more than trailers, but Johnny Tsunami was the first one. And I went with one called Brink, which is about rollerblading.
Never going to get that 540.
Sure you will, but you're just not talking like that.
Jimmy! I'm on a tight schedule here. Can we get these shots somewhere else?
No, I gotta get a picture of the blades in the pit. I just gotta figure out how to get rid of these losers.
I know I'm all just asking to leave.
And they'll do that for you?
Of course.
Cool.
Let's go. Come on, dude.
All right, look. Try to tell your shoulder in the rotation more. It'll help you out.
Right.
Hi. Thanks, man.
The fact that there's a Disney movie out there called Brink about rollerblading just makes me happy.
It's wonderful too. I don't know what to pair it with, but it's great.
Yes. just because when I was sort of watching this movie, I was never into the original, because this is a Disney Channel movie, or is it a...
I was going to ask you how this worked, because I pitched this and I was like, did they even have these over in Australia and New Zealand back in the day? late 90s, early 2000s, they were making these Disney Channel original movies. There's TV movies for Disney Channel, basically.
Yes.
And they pumped them out like monthly. It was like a new one every month for like a few years in a row. I'm not sure they still make them. But yeah, so that's what this was. It was just a TV movie for Disney Channel that they played a lot, like back in the day, like ad nauseum.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have been watching original Disney Channel movies, but I don't think we got them originally. They're all on Disney Plus now, which is fantastic. Right. But things like The Brink, and what was the other one that you mentioned? The
Johnny Tsunami is the other one about surfboarding and snowboarding.
Yes, of course. It has to be.
Hey, your stick, dude. Prepped and ready to rock. I even used a special wax in my private stock. Totally nectar.
You haven't seen nectar until you've seen these.
Hello, Randy.
Hey, Ronnie.
Wait a minute. You guys, are you?
Are we going to do this or what, Urchin?
Yeah, and it's just this kind of thing where I knew of them, because then I think iCarly and all these other, I'm sure that, I didn't even know, but was that Nickelodeon? I always get the two stuck in my head. Like
I think iCarly is Nickelodeon, and that's, I think it's a little later too, but it's a different channel.
There was kind of murmurings of these things that I had heard of, but I wasn't really watching them, because my era of Disney was the cartoons. It was Darkwing Duck, it was DuckTales, it was Gummy Bears. And so when I first got Disney Plus, I realized I was more nostalgic for the TV themes more than anything else. I don't actually remember the show, but I remember the opening credits. So those are absolutely spectacular trailers. For my two trailers I decided to show for Smart House, I kind of wrote down some notes of a lot of directions. But I decided to go, my first trailer, I was going to go for something a little bit different, but I was going to go from Psycho 4 from 1990, directed by McGarris.
This is Fran Ambrose on KTK, Talk of the Town.
I called because the focus of your show tonight is what makes boys kill their mothers.
Are you saying you killed your mother?
I killed some other women, too.
Want to tell us about your mother, how she drove you to become what you became?
She'd be sweet one moment, and then she'd suddenly turn mean. Don't you have any respect for the dead?
How did it all start?
Because, mother knows best. And I thought that would just be a hoot showing Nick Garris's version of Psycho with the dopiest idea of Norman Bates calling up a radio talk show when they're talking about matricide and him giving his account of him and his mother is just, I love it.
That's amazing. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I wasn't going to do this, but I think I will. I was going to go for the other big computer movie from 1999. Of course, that is The Matrix.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
It's the question that drives us, Neo.
What is the Matrix?
It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. You are a slave born into a prison for your mind.
The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy.
Try to realize the truth.
What truth?
There is no spoon.
Oh, nice. Okay. I like it.
Yes, just because, computers and 1990 and taking very strong, actually, I was watching Matrix recently. The technology feels sound, even though it's all dial-up, when we get into Smart House, I was just questioning, okay, so how does this all work exactly? and so within that, we might as well get into Smart House, directed by LeVar Burton, Geordie LaForge himself. So we've got two great science fiction notables with this double as well. Geordie LaForge with Stanley Kubrick for the Disney movie Smart House.
Ow! You didn't tell me that thing was going to bite me.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just Pat's way of getting to know you.
Angie Cooper, age 9, 52 inches tall, 62 pounds, blonde hair, brown eyes, 12% body fat, had measles and one early case of pneumonia, no broken bones.
Whoa. How'd you know all that?
The bite. The bite you felt was a tiny microscopic blood and tissue sample. And she analyzed your DNA, registered your body temperature, and then broke down your entire medical history.
Wow. Impressive.
The thing about Pat is the more time she spends with you, the more she learns. So before long, she's going to know more about you than you know yourself.
Well, that's kind of creepy, isn't it? I mean, it's like Big Brother is watching you, only Big Brother turns out to be your house.
Well, she's not interested in judging you or spying on you, Mr. Cooper.
Nick.
Now, when you were talking about your trailers before, I assume this is a movie that you at least watched as a kid back in the 99, early 2000s?
Yes, and I had, like, I was 12, 13, so I was kind of right on the precipice of getting a little too old for this stuff, and I was, like, getting a little too cool for it, but I had a younger sister, so I feel like she was still watching Disney Channel a lot, and I would get into a lot of these movies. They were kind of aim, I think, at, like, middle school kids, like, 12, 13, because all the movies starred, like, kids about that age. Like, actually, Smart House starred a kid who I think says he's in eighth grade. So I feel like they were kind of aimed at me, even though it was like they seemed younger. But yeah, they played these original movies on Disney Channel a lot. Like they would play them like all day, like all the time. They would debut them like once a month and they would just keep playing them. So I saw Smart House a lot back in the day.
I had not heard of Smart House until you suggested we watch it. So I did not know that there was a movie about a computer house that had Katie Sagal in it. Didn't know it was directed by Jordan LaForge. I knew none of this. So sitting down to watch it, I didn't quite know what to expect. But it definitely feels in line with those 90s kids movies that were about kids kind of taking on this adult role older than they're meant to be, but not in a dark way, but in a blank check way. If you remember that movie from.
Oh, I love Blank Check.
Yeah.
You can do that one at some point and pair it with something. Cause I love Blank Check.
Oh, it's just this stuff. Even when I was watching them, bridging it back in the mid 90s, I was like, all this stuff costs more than $1 million. How much money does this kid have?
I was thinking that too. I was like, even in 90s money, this is extreme. Like the house alone would blow most of his budget, I think.
I would have thought that would be a multi-million dollar house, even in 1990 money. It was just, so Smart House has this quality to it, which kind of took me back to the mid 90s, which I got all very nostalgic for, even though it was set in 1999 and some of the music it pulled made me feel very old, because I knew exactly who they were and may have had those singles even as a 17-year-old or, you know, 16-17-year-old. But I guess we'll get into the actual story, which is a eighth grader, Ben Cooper, which is such a Disney name, wins a house for his family that happens to be a smart house. Like you have smart phones, smart Google. It's essentially a house that is run by Amazon one called the smart
Alexa.
It's okay, because I've got a Google Plus, so thank goodness it didn't go on. I've got a Google Home, and if you've got an Alexa, that is essentially who's running your house. But if it was magic, so when you were watching this as a kid, did you question any of the technology at the time, or were you just, of course, this house is great, this house can do anything?
Well, I was old enough to question some. The thing I question the most in this movie is that they will ask for the house. Pat is its name. The stand in here is Pat.
Yes.
So they ask Pat for like food, and food will just like emerge out of places. Like I don't know where the food is being kept. Like, I don't know, it's like out of a countertop, there comes like a banana, a split or something. And it's like, where did that come from? And I question technology. The biggest one, I think, is there's a whole thing with like trash. They have a party and like, like, just push all the trash on the floor, guys. And then it sucks all the trash through carpet. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, so things like that, there seems to be food coming up through countertops and trash somehow being sucked through carpet, which I don't understand at all, but you know, movie magic. It's
it really is. I mean, not to mention is that how did this 13-year-old go into the draw to win a house? Why is this company giving away a multi-million dollar prototype of said house that I'm sure millionaires would love, but they're giving it to a normal middle-class family. And also it's, I mean, yeah, the movie has actually some very Disney-esque sort of themes, especially in the episode I just did with Chris on the Aristocats and Rugrats, about sort of getting the family kind of back together into a more traditional unit, which is all this movie. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it just got that kind of mid-90s sitcom feel, which I was just really enjoying, because you can tell Friends and even Sex and the City were influencing this thing. And it was just this kind of sweet, but very sweetly. But yeah, just because you've got the single dad with two kids, he's actually doing pretty well. I mean, the family.
Yeah, I thought he...
Yeah, he's doing a pretty good job. He's not ignoring his kids. He's doing his best. Okay, it's not perfect. The older son obviously thinks he needs to take over his mother's role, which is to be the cook and the cleaner. He doesn't necessarily think a mother does anything else, which we'll get into. But it's just this kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, but he wants more. He thinks it can be better. So he wins them a house. And the dad's like, yeah, sure, why not? We'll move into this new house. I've just got to imagine the small print on that contract he would have had to have signed would have been insane.
Yeah, the contest is weird. It's like, it's funny because they make a big deal, I think, of it being like a contest that you enter online. Mm. And it's like, and they even had that great line, talk about a throwback in the 90s, where the dad's like he's talking to his son. He's like, Ben, have you been on the internet? Because I got to get phone calls here. He's saying, you got to get off the internet because you're blocking the phone line, which I haven't heard that phrase in like 20 years from my family. So he's entering online, and I was thinking that too. I was like, I guess anyone under 18 or over can enter this contest. And the weird thing I caught this time was that the contest was only seemed to be limited to people in this county, this one town or something. Mm. It was like, it wasn't like a nationwide contest. That really seemed like it would increase your chances. And he keeps putting in entries. Like, he's just like bombarding them with like entries over and over. And I was like, well, good odds to win if it's only one town and you've entered like 300 times.
Well, yeah, I think he even says, I've taken a quarter up of the entries. Like, yeah. he's really kind of doing the odds in his favor to actually win this house. And it's just this, okay, so I'm just like sitting there go, yep, okay, this is the mid-90s. This is a classic behavior of what you wish for. Kids doing something strange that a usual kid wouldn't be able to do. Yep, okay, I got that. And then you kind of meet the house. And it's, one, I love Katie, how does he pronounce it?
I think it's
Seagal.
Katie Seagal, I think.
Seagal, yeah.
Yeah.
I love her even from Married with Children. And then I realized that she did other things and she's actually a really good actor. I just love her presence. She's just got this very, I don't know. I really, really like her. So to have her voice, this very distinctive voice kind of doing it, and then kind of seeing her evolution, which we don't necessarily see in 2001, of how she kind of changes, how she's kind of reprogrammed again. And it kind of sends her crazy. Oh, yeah. It does seem to crazy in a sense. So it's,
I have so many things to say about Smart House, I'm realizing. I'm trying to organize my thoughts here. Because yeah. I love your trailer picks, too, because they hit on two things I think are pretty, like, big in the movie, which was, I didn't think about this, but this was 99, Matrix was 99. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, was this all, like, a kind of... maybe not so much Matrix, but this movie, was this like a weird kind of showing our fear of Y2K and the Y2K bug, because technology absolutely turning against us, yeah, going wacky. I just thought that was interesting. I was like, oh, is this like a weird Y2K fear thing? and the Psycho 4 thing, because I want to point out that the main kid played by Ryan Merriman, who was a kid who was like a kid actor in some other Disney stuff. He was also in Final Destination 3, I believe, is one of the leads. He, me and my sister still joke about this, that he kind of comes across like a little bit of a psycho in this movie, because there's some things that he says that if you cut them together and score them differently, would come across like a horror movie. At one point, I think he like looks at his dad and was like, or maybe his sister, and he says something like, why would we need a mom? We have everything we need here. And it sounds just kind of crazy if you really like think about it for 3 seconds.
Oh, that kid is the ultimate cock blocker. He is, mm-hmm. Every single time his dad wants to get close to Jessica Steen, the very cute and helpful creator of Pam, or Pat, sorry.
It's okay.
it's he just gets in between them. He starts making thing. And yeah, he does not think he needs a mother because he doesn't real. Oh, he's got this weird. Yeah. He's a bit of a psychopath because what he thinks a mother does is literally the servant job. Like, cause he goes, oh, I can do that job. And it's literally cooking and cleaning. And it's not like, oh, your dad just might want to be with someone. It's not necessarily about you getting a mother. It's about him getting a wife. Now, I know this is a personal question because you do, in fact, have a stepfather. So I can cut this out if it's too personal. But you, that sort of coming into the family and you having to readjust, it's not that he's your father. It's just that he's now in your life and taking up this kind of weird role. Would that be correct? Or depending on your relationship with him?
No, it's fine you brought this up because I was about to bring it up too. Because I had not seen Smart House in quite a few years at this point. I remembered most of it, but I was thinking like, wow, I probably should have related to this even more than I was at the time. But because so the main kid, the family, the mom has died. She's not like divorced or anything. She passed away. And the main kid is like obsessed with her not being replaced by someone, which is why he doesn't want his dad to date anyone. At the beginning, he like takes a message for his dad from a woman and then like throws it away. You know, he doesn't want like her. So I was even thinking, so I can relate to this kid on that level, but I can be sympathetic to him. But on the other hand, I'm like, okay, kid, you're being a little crazy because I never did anything remotely like this kid did. Like, I was not, when my mom started dating guys again and got remarried, I was around about the same age as this kid and was not like thrilled with it, honestly.
As you wouldn't be. I mean, this is not something that most kids are thrilled about when their parents remarry. It's just
so I kind of had the same fears. Like I feel empathy when he's like, I don't want mom to your place. I'm like, I get it, kid, but I would never go to the extremes he's going to. And me and my stepdad get along fine, but we've this is a lot for a Smart House podcast, but we've never been super close. But and I kind of appreciate that he didn't really try to like come in and replace and be my dad. So we were okay, but I think when this is kind of a messed up story, but when my mom told us that they had gotten engaged to get married, me and my sister both were like, I think we both kind of like made this noise like, oh no, or something like, and then went and sat down and moped on the stairs. My mom was like, what's wrong with you two? That was not cool. And we're like, sorry. Like, this sounds, we were nice children, but we were shitty about that. I don't remember why. I think we were just like really taken aback that they were getting engaged and we acted kind of shitty about it. We were probably like, I would say I was 11 or 12. My sister was probably like 7 or 8 or 9 or somewhere in that range. So we kind of like didn't take it super well right away. But yeah, I mean, this kid is about to fly off the handle. Me and my sister still to this day laugh and joke and quote this line where, cause the sister is much cooler with it than him. Cause she's much younger and doesn't remember the mom hardly at all.
Yes.
And at one point the sister says something really innocent, like, wouldn't it be nice for dad to go on a date? And then the brother, the main kid just goes, you're so ignorant. Like, he just like freaks out and yells at her. And me and my sister will still yell at each other, you're so ignorant, for no reason. Like, cause it's such a dramatic line reading. And speaking of dramatic line reading, sorry. There's a line way later from the dad, when the dad and Ben, the main kid, are having a real heart to heart, which actually I thought was pretty good. I was like, I'm surprised this didn't get me more emotional when I was younger, but about like how no one will replace his mom. The dad has this great, like, capital A acting moment is what I call it, because he's like, you're not the only one who lost someone, Ben. Like, it's like very like acting. But it's like, it kind of hits in a weird way. The dad's actually pretty good. He comes across as like, this guy seems like a genuine dad. Everything he says screams like, I'm a dad, like, to me.
Kevin Kline actually gives a really good performance because, yeah, he is ultimate sitcom dad. And even when he's kind of getting upset at his son for constantly cock-blocking him, though I'm very very happy to know that you didn't demand to go on your mother's dates, because that just would have been awkward.
No, I didn't take her messages from her. I didn't ever try to sabotage anything intentionally. I didn't throw that much of a fit about it. I was not doing the housework either. I was a very lazy child. I was not like making breakfast or anything. So none of that, none of that.
Yeah, none of that, none of that. But it was, you know, he's really, really good. And he's just that very affable kind of 90s sitcom performance. But he does, when he has to get emotional, he really, really does. And I think in a lot of ways, he's kind of the heart of it, just because I don't think Katie Sagal gets to, because she is meant to be this robot who kind of goes crazier, crazier and crazier. And then you've got this psycho kid who's like, the part where he kind of breaks into wherever the main system computer is of the house.
Oh, yeah.
I never quite figured out where in the house it was. And he's like giving her all this information of what he thinks a perfect mother is, because he thinks, oh, if I can make the house the mum, then I don't need, my dad doesn't need to date. Again, not understanding that the dad just wants to be with someone as me. It's probably pretty lonely.
Right.
And yeah. And it's this kind of amazing thing where it's like mother knows best, all these kind of mothery sitcoms. And that's kind of what starts driving her kind of mental, but it's, and it, which when we get into Hell, that's kind of where my theory of, because I haven't seen 2010, I haven't read any of the books, kind of is going to come from. But it's just this weird kind of moment of him, yeah, being a little psychopath. He's almost like a crazy mother and psycho. Like, he knows best. He's does not want his father to have any dirty kind of thoughts about anyone else. It's going to be very pure. And before you know it, the dad's looking at someone in the shower and is about to kill with a knife.
That's what it feels like. He's one step away from like being in the background with a knife about to like kill this woman or something. Yes. Like, this kid's on the edge, man. I'm telling you. It's
he's dancing to Five and getting ready for his party, which is maybe the most adorable thing I've seen in a while.
Oh my god, we've got to talk about this party scene, because again, a scene that I still think about to this day. Because yeah, Pat is pretty cool to start, and she's like, their dad goes out one night on a date, and then they're just like kind of bored, and she's like, Pat has like already called or I think emailed. That was a big deal. She emailed all his friends or something and spread the word about a party. And I love that like his two friends show up, and this is an iconic scene, by the way. His two
friends is it? It's iconic.
and then they're just like, I don't know what they even, how they even get to this point, but this is so weird. So then he like says like, I think the line is, hey Pat, can you put up some kick butt video screens? Music videos or something, and they put on this like fifth rate boy band song that's like,
oh,
and then
Five. They bring up I had this album so do not question my disparage. Oh no, when we get into like, there's a certain Fair Street episode coming up, and my music taste will be completely exposed. But yeah, I'm just watching this, and the fact that I knew who Bewitched was, which is the music that the little girl is watching in her bedroom.
That's right.
And then when we get to the scene of like, yeah, like some kick butt music video, and then they show Five. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You're Disney in 1999. You can afford NSYNC. What is happening?
Okay, they're called Five? Is that the name of the band?
It's Five.
That's it? Five? They just gave up? They're like, Five guys, Five, we're done.
Yeah, that's it. This is
that's
the, point
the laziest band name.
Oh, the British pop scene in the late 90s was the laziest thing ever. It was literally, okay, I think one thing had like almost 10 people in it, because it was just like, yeah, we just need boys and girls dancing around. And yeah, it was just called Five.
Wow, and, okay.
And it was, they would, now looking back, it looks obscure because you're like, who are those guys? And I'm just sitting there texting an old high school friend of mine going, holy shit, I'm just watching a movie and Five has popped up. And she's like, oh my God, what is it? I'm like, you know, she's like, no, never heard of it. And then I know she watched it, and it was a reminiscing thing.
Amazing. Which song is that? I thought the one that's like, there's a great song like The House is Jumpin', which is like a song that like, I think they play on Disney Channel a lot. It was like, I'm not going to perform it, but it's like the House is Jumpin' is like the main theme to Smart House. And there's
like like raising the roof with their hands. It was hilarious.
Right. It's a dance line, not a conga line, but like a, I don't know what you call it. People line up on both sides. You dance down the middle. I feel like I see it at weddings a lot.
It's the grease. I call it the grease dance. I don't know, because that's the only time I've ever seen that thing of when they're, they're going down the middle of the line. And
And then like, I've never in my whole life at that age, I didn't like have friends. We didn't like do choreographed dance together, like out of nowhere. Like these three boys like know how to do this. They're like into this dance immediately. And I love in the background, you can see the little sister looking at them like, you idiots. Like, she's like, this is so lame.
Oh yeah. No, that is the actual reaction that you should have to watching. Like, I know when I was a teenager, you dance to whatever video just to think, but I don't know, just to see it again from my old nearly middle-aged eyes, I'm just like going, oh no, that was never cool. No, stop it.
Oh, it's something. I just realized too, we've talked about all these like little things around, like all these little things going on. We haven't talked about like how this is like 2001 A Space Odyssey. People are like, what are they talking about?
Yes, no, there is a thematic theme, and her name is Pat. Yes. Much like Hal, she is the best computer ever that will never make a mistake and is not human until she interacts with humans and becomes more and more of what she thinks a human needs to be, which is exactly like Hal from 2001. And you only hear her voice for the first two acts, two-thirds of the movie. Like, she's not, she's just a voice in the house. You'll say hello, she'll say hello back. Much like the absorbing carpet that can swallow everything. I don't know how many times you have to clean that. She will just kind of, you know, give you oranges or give you banana smoothies magically. She is kind of this omnipotent. Am I saying the word correctly?
That's right. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yes, that sounds right. And yeah, she's kind of the center of the movie and is kind of this magic computer element that can do everything. And as she gets to know this family, becomes more and more in their life and, like, you know, throws a party because she wants to help Ben kind of loosen up and have fun like a kid. Or she kind of, which I thought was funny, especially watching it, I guess now, is that the dad now gets to work from home because he has a computer set up.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, oh, if other people could go back to, I would love to go back to work. But it was just that kind of thing of like, oh, no, you can do your job from home because now we have this technology and it'll run smoother. And I'm like, oh, my God, lift my own devices. I do like an hour of work and then I just start like surfing the net, looking up different Wikipedia articles and things like that, and Blu-ray releases and things like that. I'm really not productive. Like, I could not work at home.
I'm doing okay. I've been working from home for like since last March.
Yeah. And
I love it so much. Like, I never want to go back to the office. Like, I think I'm more productive at home because then, like, on the weekends, like, if I wake up like kind of early and like nothing's going on yet and I want to watch a movie, I'm like, well, I could just watch a movie downstairs or I could watch that same movie upstairs while I'm working because my job doesn't like require too much brain power. So it's mostly a lot of like kind of just making things go in the system. And so I can kind of watch stuff while I'm doing it and not lose focus. And I feel like if I had to go to my office, I wouldn't go there on the weekend. But if I'm at home, I'm like, well, I want to watch a movie. I can just walk upstairs. I can do some stuff while I'm watching it. So it's the best. I don't want to go back, honestly. So.
No, it's this really interesting divide of people who love the office, love the interaction with people, who just know that they do more work when they kind of are in an environment to do work. Or those people who are just like, oh, I don't want ever to go back to the office again. This is perfect.
It is. It really is. I do think it's funny that, like, I think Pat was doing really well before Ben went and messed her up, because I'm like, man, kid, you really had it good. And then he loads her up with these, like, 50 sitcoms. They're all, like, the most generic made-up 50 sitcoms. Like, leave it to mom, and, like, mom knows best.
Like,
and then,
can we just, like, take other sitcoms that we know and just add mom in the title?
It's like, you're Disney. You have money. What are you doing? but they give all these, he's like, this is what a mom should be like. And I'm like, oh my God, this kid does not get it. I'm like, kid, you've been through sex ed family life class. You should understand. Like, it's like your dad wants a human partner. But he doesn't get that. So he's like, we'll make Pat the mom. Like, oh my God. So he loads her up all these sitcoms and then she gets like very like, kind of annoying. I feel like, you know, it's like they ask her for some food and she's like, you need a daily serving of fruits and vegetables, you're gonna have this instead of what you want. And it's like, oh, Pat. And then
she doesn't leave the house because she wants him to wear a jacket, or she doesn't Right. Like the thing he's wearing or something kind of weird and just locks the door. It's just like, oh, no, no, no.
He gets punched in the face at school, the main kid, and then he comes home and has a black eye and Pat's like, put a stake on it. And the dad's like, no one's done that since the 50s.
Yes.
And all this stuff. And then it gets even worse. I had forgotten Pat does not take a form. It's a virtual form. But like Katie Sagal doesn't get to like appear in the movie really until the last 15 minutes where she takes this like very stereotypical 1950s housewife form. And then is like, you know, raging against them and like going really, really nuts.
Until when the house is going full poltergeist or going full kind of haunted house, when they're all having to sleep in the living room because she just has gone, no, no one's leaving this house. you're mine. And this is that. And so it's, she's kind of the center of the movie, but she's kind of in the background a lot of the time because she's just kind of this, again, it's a kids movie. So it's, be careful what you wish for, or be careful what you're downloading onto your smart house's server, I guess. Because, you know, who wants to live in whoever seen Pleasantville, you know that it's not always the best place to live. So it's just this kind of weird thing about how she only really comes into focus as she gets more crazy and crazy, and then they have to kind of pull her back into being a normal computer system again.
Yeah, it's and then it kind of wraps up very quickly. I'd forgotten like that the last 15 minutes is full of stuff and wraps up and it's like, oh, it's over. OK, it's a pretty short movie. It's like an hour and 20 minutes long. It's like it really flies by.
It really does, because I was sort of getting swept up into the sort of drama of this family of, you know, them just living their life and being kids and being a single dad. We're trying to work and all that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden having this kind of almost ghostly presence in this house, but at the same time, she doesn't always make life easier. She's just this kind of, especially as she gets more and more kind of focused on what Ben thinks is a mother's job, she gets very more controlling, much more kind of interruptive in everyone's daily life, and doesn't let them make any decisions. And that's just kind of sort of fascinating as the movie, you forget that you're not really interested in the smart house. You're interested in the family, but by the time you get to the end of the movie, it's all the Pat show.
Yeah, yeah. very, very 2001 influence, basically. When like, you're not going to shut me down, you know, that all stuff. That's I don't know why. I don't know how this came to me, but I mean, that's why I was probably linking them thematically. Was two computer systems who pretty much take care of all the daily stuff for people, and then when they try to get messed with or shut down, they just lose it and start rebelling. I don't know what, now I don't know what else to say. I feel like I had so much to say, and I'm like, that's Smart House. It's like because I think it's a fun movie, honestly. Of all the Disney Channel originals, I actually feel like it holds up better than a lot of them, honestly. I don't know about you, just watched it, so yeah, you probably know better than I would.
No, it was kind of this thing of, I thought it was a really strong movie. It was stronger than I thought it was going to be, just because I think I had in my head what I think a Disney Channel movie is. And then you watch it and like, oh, this is, yeah, it has those elements, but those are comforting elements to me. Like, I kind of know how the beats are going to go already just because I've seen mountains of TV from there. So I kind of already know, but at the same time, it's, the fact that it is actually pulling from 2001, the fact that it is pulling from this kind of almost haunted house kind of vibe from it, even the beginning of when you see the paperboy not throwing the paper correctly and this thing just comes out of the house. Like, it's got some very 1999 CG in it, but it's not that intrusive. So you're not like going, oh, yikes, that's like the Mummy Returns or anything, but it's just kind of around the edges. But it's kind of this almost like a dangerous presence to begin with, and you're kind of like going, this is not a good idea, none of this is. Do you sort of get, when you're watching it now, do you sort of get those nostalgic kind of things of that late 90s sort of period of like, oh, I remember going at this when you're going back to school, when you're a kid sort of watching it? Or do you sort of look at it now and sort of see the all the references in it that you probably weren't getting when you first watched it?
No, I gives me that feeling of comforting nostalgia, honestly. And it's like, the kids were probably about my age, honestly. And So I feel like I'm just looking at it and like looking at like stuff they're wearing. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of like, I forgot how fucking big clothes were. Like I just was like, the boys are wearing like this huge jackets and huge pants. Even their shoes are big. Like they have like these big, like, you know, like skater shoes. If I was like, at one point when they're dancing, I'm like, even his tennis shoes are huge. Like these guys, it's like everything was just big, ugly. I feel like it looks like an Old Navy ad from like 1989 where it's like a lot of bright, like, I bought like an orange like vest I thought was the coolest thing ever, like an orange fleece vest from Old Navy around this time. And I'm like, I could have walked right in this movie and just looked like I fit right in.
I don't know what it was about big pants in the 90s. Like nothing fit. Like everything was too small. It was either too tight or it was just too big. Like I had this pair of overalls that I loved, but they were three sizes too big. So literally when you clip them up, they were halfway down my chest. But they were the coolest things I had owned, and I loved them to death, even though I think my mother would just look at me and go, okay, she's a teenager, she'll grow out of it. But yeah, you do get this sort of sense when you're watching it of, oh, this is how, because I mean, you watch The Matrix and that's kind of how you wished you could be that cool to dress in all that leather, even though it was not comfortable. You watch Smart House and you're like, no, that's actually how we dressed. We wore oversized pants, shirts, and everything was just ill-fitting in this weird way that you can't. Yeah, the people's idea of what the 90s were wasn't exactly what the 90s were, if that makes sense.
No, you're right. There was a lot of weird, like late 90s, early 2000s specifically. I feel like I'm thinking things got like really big. Did you guys have pants over there? The brand JNCOs? Do you have JNCOs pants over there?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. Yeah. All about. So I mean, my mom one summer before school, like go on a hunt with me to find JNCOs because I had to have JNCOs because they were like the coolest pants and they were huge. Like if you jumped out of a plane with JNCOs on, you'd probably be okay because they would just like inflate and become parachute pants. You could float to the ground. Like everything was just weird. And like, yeah, it was a very ugly time for fashion, I feel like.
It really was. And it's just amazing when you watch kind of, movies from there, which are all kind of making it look very cool. And you're like, no, that's not. Yeah. But then you watch some other movies and you're like, oh, no, that's exactly how people were dressing. like I know you were mentioning watching an episode that had just come out when we were recording with Carmelita, the great Carmelita on Legends, and you mentioned that you're watching Airheads and you were sort of saying, yeah, no, that movie is from 1994. And I'm like, yeah, no, I remember that movie. That is that is what people dress like. That is what people kind of look like. And it wasn't particularly flattering.
Very authentically 1994 Airheads.
It's like, yes.
it's so funny. Yeah, I mean, I liked like Fear Street 94, but like when you watch that version 94 and you watch a movie like Airheads, which is from 94, you can see like how different they are and like how different the fashion they get in those movies. So it was funny. Yeah. It's like, it's funny. Cause I always thought like the grunge look kind of cool. Cause I kind of missed that. Cause I was too young, you know, to be really picking out my own clothes or dressing trendy, yeah, you know? Mm. So I always thought the grunge look kind of cool, honestly. Like I thought it looked better than the stuff in like 99, 2000, but maybe that's just me being biased. I don't know.
I don't know. I remember keep getting annoyed because when I was a teenager, sort of in that mid-90s period when everything was either midriff showing and really like low-rise jeans, and I remember hating it because I'm just like going, I am not built for crop tops and low-rise jeans. That is just no. So when everything sort of started getting really, really baggy in the late 90s, I was just like, thank you, just thank you.
It helped. I was a chubby boy at that time, so it really it helped me out too. I was like, cool, I can wear these really baggy clothes, and it was good for me too. I was like, cool, I can wear these just giant shirts and giant pants, and
cargo pants were big, and I loved them.
What a time to be alive! It was.
It really was. Anything else about Smart House before we move on to the main event?
No, I feel like, I got my main points about how it's like 2001 with the Pat thing, how the kid's a little bit of a psychopath. Yes. Talk about that party scene. Yes. It is so funny watching this now with things like Alexa and Google Dot Echo, those kind of things being in houses. It's so weird that like, I was thinking Smart House kind of predicted a lot of things 20 years ago about how you talk, you know, people just because they would say like, Pat, can I? It's a little more advanced because they're like, Pat, can I have a smoothie? Alexa can't make you a smoothie. But, you know, it's like,
she could
Pat,
order a smoothie. She's on. This close from being able to order a smoothie from Uber, though.
Right. It's true. It's true. Yeah. But yeah, so I just think it's funny that like, wow, Smart House, a little bit ahead of the curve with smart like technology in homes. And like, it's kind of close in a weird way. So.
It really is. Because whenever we sort of, I watch, say, an older science fiction movie with my sort of partner, we always sort of note, oh, yes, they're focusing on this. And I went, yeah, no, I don't think movies in the 80s and early 90s got that we were going to use communication. That's where it was going to go. Like, it wasn't necessarily about the robot or the thing or the RoboCop or whatever. It's actually about how we communicate. It's, you know, now every time so you see FaceTime, like we'll see in 2001, is very close to how we communicate now. But it was just this kind of thing of, yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's all this kind of, this movie and The Matrix was all this kind of Y2K stress about, oh, shit, we have this thing now, and we're going to go into a new century, and it's all, we don't know where this is going to go. But, you know, Smart House is actually, apart from the really absorbent carpet, it's, it's, because seriously, how do you clean that? that was my big obsession.
It bothers me. It bothered me then, it bothers me now. I'm like, does it make any sense? Because they're... How do you suck like cups and plates through a floor? Like, it doesn't make sense. It's like,
sucked a person in there. What's happening?
A little sister gets pulled through the floor. No, it's like, it's the one part that really is like outlandish, honestly. Yeah. But, oh, I will say this before we stop talking about Smart House is that amazingly, that the CGI special effects in Smart House are somehow worse than the effects in 2001, which is 30 years earlier than Smart House. I was like, wow, that's incredible. The effects hold up better in 2001 than they do in Smart House.
Oh my God. Some of those effects in Smart House, I'm just like going, yep, it's 1999. Yep, that's they did not give their Disney Channel funds for actual proper, like, they couldn't. I'm like, Disney could afford NSYNC. No, we're going to give you 5. Can we actually do some CGI and make it look good? No.
Nope, can't give you any money. Sorry.
Can't
sorry,
give you any money. Sorry, sorry. Sorry, LaVerburn. You got what you got. But he actually just directed a kind of a tight little movie, and he kind of brushed over the things that don't make sense. He realized the main love interest had to have terrible taste in men because it was 1999 and everyone was watching Sex and the City and Friends. And that's kind of what dating was like. I had a very skewed view of what dating was going to be like until I started dating. I went, oh, it's nothing like that. And I just don't talk about boys every 5 seconds. It was very strange. But at the same time, yeah, it's a movie that kind of knows what it is Jordan LaForge. So he has gone to places that, is it no man has ever seen before? I can't remember the Star Trek.
Oh boy. Now that you said it, boldly go where no man has gone before.
I mean, yeah. So Jordan LaForge has actually gone into 2001 territory. So he knows what he's talking about when it comes to the technology, but I just love the fact of how grounded and of its time it is, especially with the clothes and the jokes and the everything like that. And with that, we are going to go into one of the more daunting movies that I think has ever been made. That I will get into my relationship with this movie. But first, before the blank screen with the noise starts, Matt, what is your first trailer that you would show for 2001?
Okay, so again, not my strong suit, the trailers, but I picked two movies that are like newer that I know are heavily influenced by 2001. Yeah. So the first one I chose was Christopher Nolan's Interstellar.
You're a well-educated man, Coop, and a trained pilot.
And an engineer.
The world doesn't need any more engineers. We didn't run out of planes and television sets. We ran out of food.
Why did you name me after something that's bad?
Oh, we didn't.
Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law doesn't mean that something bad will happen. It means that whatever can happen will happen.
Oh, yes.
which, wow, is that movie, his version, 2001.
yeah, the thing... Yes, it is. It's kind of if he, because he's also very David Lean, I've noticed. So he can't help but kind of have that David Leanness kind of with epicness with it. And it's, so yeah, but Interstellar is, I love parts of that movie and I am frustrated with a lot of that movie as well. Probably my same relationship with 2001, to be honest.
Interesting. And I will say this about Interstellar, and I always tell people to watch it this way. This is how I watch Interstellar. I saw it at home, probably a couple years after it came out. I was very sick with like the flu or something, and it was super late and I couldn't sleep, like 1 or 2 in the morning. Mm. And I was really high on like cough medicine and I loved it. Like I was like, I was like, I felt like I took a trip at Interstellar. Like it hit me like the perfect way. And I know people have a lot of problems with that movie. I really, really like Interstellar. But I, with all those caveats, I did watch it under the influence of cough medicine. Like pretty, I don't know how I stayed awake for the whole thing because it's kind of long and it was super late, but I was hooked in. Like it got its hooks in me very quickly and I was like blown away by the thing. But again, may have been the medicine. I'm not sure. I have never gone back to rewatch it because I don't want to, I always say I don't want to break the spell because sometimes movies hit you and you're like, ooh, if I watch that again, it may not hit the same way. And I feel like that's very true of Interstellar.
Oh, because, yeah. Yeah, yes.
It feels like a very special set of circumstances that I don't think I can replicate unless I'm, again, sick and throwing down cold medicine. But I just don't want to even touch it again. But I was kind of blown away by it when I first saw it. So I really like Interstellar. So
yeah, I have the same relationship with Inception. I have never seen Inception except that one time in the theater, and I loved it so much. I am terrified to watch that again because if it's just on, even though I have a pretty decent sized television, I don't think I could replicate that experience. So I'm terrified of watching it again.
Oh, I love Inception too. And I've watched that one many times actually at home. Like it's one of the things that comes on TV now or it pops up and I have to watch at least part of it. Cause I just love the music in it, the images, like something of that movie just like really like gets to me. And like, I really, really love that movie. I think it's better than Interstellar. And that one, I think, has held up under multiple viewings, honestly. So maybe give it another shot. I feel like it kind of works. So
I might have to, because I have seen Interstellar the first time in a theater. And then my partner bought a 4K of it. And just because he loved. Actually, he really, really loved this movie. Like, I think he loved the robot in it, like how it moved and just the different times with the gravity and the time and just everything about it is just his jam. And the 4K looks spectacularly beautiful. So no, I do like Interstellar. I just had this very uneven quality, much like 2001. So what is your second trailer?
The second one is a movie that just came out a couple years ago starring Brad Pitt called Ad Astra.
Major, we have some highly classified information.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
Its objective was to search for advanced extraterrestrial life. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir.
This might come as quite a shock to you. Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system.
Movie I really do adore, actually.
One
of the few people who really love this movie.
I really liked it, too. Again, a movie that I only saw once, but it really hit me. And I kind of one of those movies when it was over, I was like, I don't know how much I liked that, but I thought about it a lot, you know, where you're kind of like, it's like, that was good. And then it doesn't leave your mind for like a week or something where you keep thinking about it. Cause, strange movie, like weirdly structured. I feel like it's, didn't really know much about it going in. It was kind of mysterious and I just watched it at home randomly. And, it's something special about it. I have to watch it again, but it definitely feels like, again, like some kind of, it definitely feels like some kind of cousin of 2001: A Space Odyssey. It feels like it's going for that thing. So I do like Ad Astra, and I still have thought about it a lot, but I haven't rewatched it. So yeah, but it's interesting.
This movie's great. It really keeps you on your toes because there's so many things in it I did not expect to happen in this movie.
So many turns. I didn't know where to go.
Yeah, because it's kind of about one thing, but it takes a while to get to that one thing. Mm-hmm. And then you just get this amazing Tommy Lee Jones performance. But at the same time, you are getting all these little vignettes, which again, very 2001, of these bizarre little turns of going through space. And if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to spoil any of those little turns because you're just like watching this going, what is this does not belong in this movie. But it's all of this one piece. And I'm a little bit hot and cold on the director, Gray. I can't remember his first name.
James Gray,
but he's such a fascinating director because I didn't love City of Z. I think it's this name with Charlie... Hunnam, yes. I was going to go Kaufman. I'm like, that's not right. Charlie Hunnam. And I'm not a big Charlie Hunnam guy. And even though I thought the movie was fascinating, I thought Patterson was great. I was just something about it. And this one, I'm like, I'm not sure I'm on the wavelength, but the fact that you've just done this scene with baboons, okay, I ruined one of it, but I'm not going to tell you what happens with the baboons. I'm just like, this is a movie I want to see what happens because you're just throwing everything at the wall now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is what it feels like.
Okay, so for my trailers, I really struggle with this because what in God's name do you put in front of 2001? So I decided to, I'm going to go for my dumb picks. Sorry, I apologize for one of them. I decided to go for science fiction movies that were actually made in 2001 because 2001 is all about where we should be in the year 2001, which was not where we were in the year 2001.
We were not there.
We were not there. So my first movie is probably the classy one, but I'm going for AI from 2001.
His name is David.
I feel it.
That's creepy.
Whoa, just so real.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
Which was started by going to be a Kubrick movie, right, but then passed away and finished by Spielberg. I really like this movie. It's strange. It's very dark. It's in that period of like War of the Worlds where Spielberg was just making these really dark movies. And I think Spielberg's warmness and sentimentality with Kubrick's very coldness and starkness actually work really well, like peanut butter and jelly. And I think David, I think is the kid's name, who wants to be a real boy, is a horror figure. There are some moments when you are watching him and you are just so unsettled by his presence. And I think it really works. It's overlong, it's epic. It's, again, it's got that structure that only Kubrick could have written down. But I really do like that movie.
I have actually never seen that movie, shockingly. when it came out, I think people forget when it came out, I feel like it was kind of not controversial, but it was, I thought it was kind of, you know, not liked very well when it came out.
No, like, it wasn't because the first time I watched it, I don't think I finished it because I didn't know what it was. It was strange. It was meandering. It's very vignette-y. Very Kubrick. But then I rewatched it and I kind of just the pieces just fitted together. I would definitely worth a watch, but it is, again, not the movie you're going to expect, especially if you like Ad Astra. I think you'll like actually AI.
Yeah. I think I'd appreciate it much more now as an adult. Like I'd seen AI as a kid, from what I hear about it, I think I would probably hated that, but now it sounds very interesting. I think people really turn the other way on it, that I think it's a very good movie. So, yeah, no, I will check it out at some point, but just a never-ending watch list. So.
Oh, my God, I know. and for my final trailer, screw it, I'm going to do it. Okay, I apologize in advance because I feel this is even more offensive to show in front of 2001 than it is to pair with Smart House. Okay. But this was a science fiction movie that came out in 2001, and it is very much about going into the future of space and where humanity goes, and about the fact that, it's Jason X.
I'm sorry.
What the hell is going on?
Jason Voorhees, that's what's going on.
He's an unstoppable killing machine.
Guys, it's okay. He just wanted his machete back.
How do we get off the ship?
I don't know.
Look, we're gonna be all right.
What? Are you high?
Uh-oh.
He's here. You have got to get them out of there.
Hey, Slappy!
I think we're finally okay.
Amazing. I'm applauding you. I did not expect you to say Jason X. Oh my god, that's a fantastic pick. I love that.
I could have chosen. Look, science fiction was not a strong year in 2001, and I like this movie, god damn it. It's dumb, it's ripping off Aliens. I mean, Jason wants his machete back. People die horribly. It's got robots, it's kind of this weird, you know, freezing Jason into the year 2040 something, like thousands of years into the future. It's really, really dumb. And I just like the idea of showing something so dumb in front of a movie that is trying to be so intellectual that it almost goes to another plane. So yeah, deal with it. It's 2001.
I love that so much. I don't know if I can say I love Jason X, but I appreciate Jason X because I don't know what I was thinking when I saw that movie when it came out, because I really took it at like face value and thought, this is so stupid. How could they have made this? And then I'm going back years later. I'm like, oh, this was all on purpose. Like, yes, they knew what they were doing. Oh. Like, they didn't, you know, they didn't think they were making like high art here. This was all kind of jokey to them. Like, there's some stuff I love in that movie. It has one of the best kills in the whole series too, with that whole like,
all the frozen,
smash thing. Yeah. That's, so yeah, I kind of like Jason X. So I love that you paired something like so stupid with 2001. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it is a stupid movie. I mean, this has David Cronenberg at the beginning, and how do you not like a movie that has David Cronenberg in it? Yeah, it's got one of the best kills in the series. It when it Liz lulls, it really lulls. Very much like Jason Goes to Manhattan, when there's nothing happening, there's really nothing happening. But it is just a really entertaining. Well, I think it's entertaining. And yeah, I'm going to dumb you out before I go into maybe one of the more intellectual movies ever made. And with that, cue the music. We're going into the depths of the monolith. It is 2001.
Dave, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind.
Now, before I get to sort of everyone's got to, this is from 1968, so this is a historic movie. It has influenced every single science fiction movie that's come afterward, even Star Wars, to the movies you mentioned, to everything that kind of set in space. But on this watch, it was the first time this movie felt like an actual movie. I've never considered this an actual movie. I've considered it something else, if that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. It's more like a piece of art that you just kind of watch in front of you and go, yes, yes. Like, you kind of nod your head like, yes, very well made.
Yes, well made. I don't know what is happening, but it is well made. I can tell you that much.
So yeah, do you remember the first time you saw 2001? Like, was it when you were pretty young or was it later? I'm just curious now.
I was 20 and living in Wellington, where there's this gorgeous retro theater called the Embassy, which is very important to New Zealand because it is owned by Peter Jackson. It is where the premiere for Return of the King happened. You know, it's kind of like the cornerstone. Not the cornerstone, but it's, you know, it's Art Deco, it's gorgeous, it's kind of an institution. And once a month, they would play 2001 as a midnight show. So we decided to have the idea of smoking a certain weed, kind of weed, before you went. I only made it through to the Blue Danube, the dancing spaceships, and I fell asleep. So that was my first experience. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening, I did smoke a little bit of the devil's lettuce back in the day. I apologize, but you knew. When did you first see this movie?
Well, bravely enough, I took this on as a teenager because wow. I feel like, I don't have the greatest attention span either. So I took this on somewhere in my teenage years when I was, and I always joke, I with air quotes, getting into cinema with like a snooty tone, like, because 2001 kind of falls in that. I was thinking about this, like, I feel like there are just movies that, if you're someone who's getting into movies, they, you almost have to like check boxes. Like, I've got to watch this. You got to watch The Godfather. Yes, you've got to watch this and Kane. You've got to watch Casablanca. 2001, I feel like, was a part of that like canon of like all time famous great movies that you have to watch if you want to be into movies. It's like, so I felt like I had to watch 2001, and my God, was I bored. I'm not gonna lie. I was like, this is, especially as a teenage boy, it was brutal. Like, you know, like, I was like, oh my God, why is he just showing me a spaceship dock for 10 minutes uninterrupted? Like, I got it, Stanley, cool. It was like a frustrating thing, even though I've always been in awe and admire the filmmaking, because I could even tell, like, it, for a movie made in 1968, I feel like it's still, to this day, there are times you can kind of tell it looks older, but a lot of times it doesn't look that old, honestly. It's kind of incredible how well it has aged. But there's so many
times. The model work is amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's like, so I mean, on the technical aspect, I've never thought it was a bad movie, but I will say this right up front. I don't know if there's a movie on the planet where there's a bigger gap between me thinking this is an amazing achievement, incredible technical achievement, and me not really liking the movie. Like, if that makes sense, where it's,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Okay, because that's probably logical to this movie too, because I know the running joke for a long time is like, it's a big important movie you have to watch, and like, a lot of people don't have the patience for it though. Like, I know I did something a couple years ago where I think I've only seen this movie about 3 or 4 times in my whole life, and like 3 or 4 years ago I was like, somehow got a bug to like watch 2001. And it's funny because I'm saying this, and I think Daniel just said this on his podcast, Adam Risky, about, because they were talking about The Killing, directed by Stanley Kubrick. Yeah. And I did the same thing he did, where he said like 2001, one night he gave it like full attention. Like, he put the phone on the other side of the room, he turned the lights off, and was like locked in, which I did a few years ago. I was like, I gotta give this movie like my full attention. And that was the best it ever had played for me. I was like, I feel like I get it. This time rewatching it, it didn't play as well. I had less patience with it than before. And I was getting kind of, I feel so bad saying this, like, that I was getting kind of annoyed, because like, there's just times when it's like, there's a scene where like a spaceship gets like descended on like a platform, and he just shows you the entire thing happen, the whole process of the platform slowly moving down. And I'm like, I don't need to see that. That's not that interesting. If I'm really being honest, I don't think, like, end of the time, I know like the effect work was groundbreaking, it's still amazing, but there's a lot of dead space in this movie that I don't have the patience for. Even though still I think it is a truly incredible movie, and it's like so influential, and I have so many good things to say about that way, but like, and there's a lot of stuff that I just don't care for. And I was thinking, like, this time I was like, I don't know when I'll watch this again. And I think unless it comes up in like a theater screening, or like they show it in like IMAX or something cool, like, you know, I don't know if I'm gonna ever watch 2001 again, because I feel like I've kind of like gotten everything out of it. And oh, this is interesting too, I feel like watching Tales of One is not that fun for me, but thinking about it and talking about it is much more interesting than watching the movie for me, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes absolute sense, because after me falling asleep in a theater watching it, I always just said, yeah, 2001, yeah, whatever. And then, because I was just expecting this psychedelic, oh, I'm stoned, I'm really going to get the lights, it's going to be this amazing thing, and I just was like, oh, I'm out. And then about 10 years ago, when I decided, because I was loved movies as when I was younger, but I never really watched a lot of classics. So about 10 years ago, I decided I'm going to watch all the AFI movies, because that way I'm going to get a good palette of what America considers its classics. And of course, 2001 is on there, and it irritated the hell out of me. It was, again, some moments I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, monkeys. Okay, yeah. Oh, how is it, like 2 hours into the movie? What? Oh, okay. And I think you're right. And they could see that what Kubrick was doing, I could tell that it was amazing filmmaking, but I also thought it was a lot of wank. Like, Kubrick is going, yes, I'm the smartest person in the room, and I don't care if you're bored, because I'm going to sit there and make you watch a ship dock for 10 minutes, or I'm going to make you watch David go through a thing like for 10 minutes uninterrupted. I'm going to make you do that because I'm smart and you're not. And then the whole ending just infuriated me. And so I was kind of in this, yeah, I get it, but I don't like it. Okay, so it was that. And then I watched Sacrilege, but I watched, this time around, I watched it in, was it two or three? Let's just say, I think I watched it in two chunks. Uh-huh. And I think even though that is sacrilege and not how the movie is meant to be watched, I think it was actually, for me, the best way to watch it, because I could digest certain parts of it, because I think it was, yeah, two or three times. And I could digest, oh, the first part with the monkeys, okay, the second part with them traveling, and then so on and so forth. And even though I still think there's some, Kubrick was a genius filmmaker, he was also a wanker, and you saw that in his films because he was very artistic. And even though I do love a lot of his movies, so that's not necessarily I don't like Kubrick. I just think I'm sometimes going, yeah, okay, we get it. You're smart. We know this. Yes.
Uh-huh. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Watching it, kind of breaking it, the movie down a little, I was able to digest it in chunks and therefore kind of saw it as a narrative when I never saw that narrative before, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. And that's, I think I had that experience the last time I'd watched it. Mm. And so it kind of was like a breakthrough thing where I'm like, I feel like I get it now. And and I will say that the thing I enjoy the most is that last like 20, 25 minutes of the movie, I think is by far my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's the most interesting stuff. It loses me a lot in the middle, a lot of the space stuff, like where he just has to show like full process of things happening. Like, because that's like a common criticism on a lot of movies where it's like, you know, I feel like if you watch a bad movie, they tend to show you whole things. It's like, why are you showing me this person start a tractor for 5 minutes? Or why are you showing this person like walk all the way from here to here? Most movies like will cut out the fat of like show, but he's trying to show off, I think, effects. And, you know, he's like, look what I did. This is so cool, which I don't blame him for because it's groundbreaking then. It still looks great. But after a while, it's like, I'm truly not getting anything like out of watching, you know,
dancing spaceships,
spaceships docking. Like there's nothing to get out of that. Like there's so little character stuff in this movie, human stuff. And I know it's like a common criticism of Kubrick to say he's like a cold filmmaker. Mm. And I think this is like where it all stems from, honestly, And I will say this, I was like, I'll watch like basically any of his movies before this one in the future. Like I would rather watch, because there's so little of a human element in this movie. It's so, you know, I think the best performance is given by the guy who voices Hal, and I can't remember his name right now, but he's like, and he's just a voice. But I feel like there's such a, it feels like this is really like Stanley Kubrick saying like, he didn't want to deal with human actors that much, even though we can get into like what we think happens at the ending and it's all about humanity and things like that. Mm. But I just feel like it's lacking this like humanity to really connect to on, because I go back to movies for like characters and moments and things like that. And, you know, there's not much to go back to for 2001, honestly. So
it's a movie that keeps falling through your fingers, which I completely agree with. And if you're, I'm like you, I like moments, I like little character details. That's when I'm really getting into movies, though, in saying that Suspiria is one of my favorite movies, and you have none of that either, but you do have this amazing texture of color and music and movement and just kind of spectacle. And this has that, but you're right, it is very cold. It is about a movie about humanity. That's what this movie is about. But I mean, even Hal succumbs to being a human. But it's so clinically cold, and I don't yeah, maybe that was Kubrick's kind of natural thing, because if you watch Dr. Strangelove, it's not a cold movie. It's a ludicrous movie, but I don't think it's that cold because you have all these amazingly warm performances. But then I haven't seen Barry Lyndon, but The Shining is an incredibly cold movie. It's set in snow. It's freezing.
Yeah.
but it is, again, a very cold movie, but with these, like, very electric performances, because you cannot take your eyes off Shelley Duvall or Jack Nicholson. But this one, he purposely did not hire anyone of name. He purposely just wanted the visuals to be the star of the movie. And I get that. And there is something hypnotic about certain things. But, and I think this is the most I've enjoyed it ever, because I went, oh, it's about the monoliths. It's not, even though it's about humanity, it's more about the monoliths and what you think those monoliths mean, and not necessarily everything in between. Like, I actually kind of enjoyed the second portion with the guy traveling. I don't know why. but him talking to his daughter, who's I think was actually Kubrick's daughter, and then sort of being coy and them finding out this possible kind of thing about the monolith, I enjoyed it a lot more than I have ever done, because it's always been my least favorite, except for some of the dancing spaceships. It's been my least favorite part, but it kind of, it's this kind of moment of humans thinking they have control over this thing, which they have no control over. I think that was my take from this time. It could change easily.
That's true. I mean, I think you're right. And the good thing about this movie, though, also, is that I feel like it's very open to different interpretations.
Oh yeah.
Kubrick, I think, wanted it that way. And it's funny, though, because he wrote this with Arthur C. Clarke, I believe, was the science fiction author.
Yes.
And it's funny because so Kubrick wants to be very like coy about it and not really tell you. And then Arthur C. Clarke goes and like writes a novelization where he pretty much gives you all the answers, I think. So that's funny. It's one of those movies that everyone's like, oh, what does it mean? But technically, it's kind of been explained, you know, through him talking about it. I even saw something where Kubrick kind of explains the ending in a way. So it's funny that everyone's like, I don't understand what's going on. They've kind of laid it out for you. But even if they've done that, I think you're right. It's still open to all these interpretations about like humans and AI and thinking we have control and, you know, humans and violence. Like, I actually like the opening a lot too with the apes. I mean, the opening shot of this movie is like one of the most epic opening shots
amazing.
Ever.
Amazing.
That starts and I'm like, oh my God, this is the best movie ever made. And I'm like, this is amazing. And with the music and then I love this. I do like stuff with the apes because it has like, it ends with like one of the monolith comes down and then like the monolith, you know, giving, I guess, oh God, there's so much to talk about. So I feel like the monoliths, as I took it, are giving, they're kind of, I don't know if they're like beings or it's a gift from like aliens who are giving it to people on Earth and saying like here, because every time it pops up, it seems like new technology spurs. So like the monolith comes down and the apes then figure out tools, which they immediately turn into weapons. Because
I know, that's like, I love that.
I was like, well,
yeah, as soon as he holds it, it's a tool, I can hit things, and then they smash that other tribe, and it's like, yeah, that tracks.
Right, very in line with what becomes human nature. It's like, okay, how can I turn this into a weapon? Like, every movie, I feel like, has been, you know, if someone invents something, the military comes in and goes, how can we use this as a weapon, you know? So I love that that's, like, the first thing they do is make it a weapon. It could have been a tool, but I'm going to destroy things with it. And, like, maybe the greatest edit jump of all time, when they throw the bone in the air and you jump thousands, maybe millions of years in the future, and it becomes what I thought was like a spaceship or a satellite, but I read this time that it's supposed to be a orbiting nuclear device. So you go from like the first weapon, the bone, to the most like advanced weapon, which is like a floating nuke in space.
Oh.
And I love that cut. Yeah, it's incredible. I think someone pointed out to me like a long time ago, I took like, it was like a film class or like a, some kind of thing with film, and we watched Part 2001, and they pointed out like, oh, look at that jump cut from the bone to the that, you know, that thing that's like the oldest weapon to the most advanced weapon, because they're kind of shaped similar too. So it's this amazing cut, and probably the biggest cut in movie history. It jumped so far. But yeah, that opening's great. I was never in love with the stuff too that you're talking about, like the guy traveling, although the stuff on the plane is kind of cool, where he's kind of, it's like a pen floating, and then like the steward is kind of walking, and with her like weird like anti-gravity booties or whatever, like her shoes. That all looks cool. And then it kind of like that middle sec, that it's a long time too, that whole section with that stuff, and then we get to the stuff with Hal later on. Like it's but then, like the last 20 minutes I think really is something special. But it's a weird movie to talk about because it's so famous and there's so much going on, and I admire it so much from a technical standpoint, but you know, it's just not a super fun movie to watch for me.
No, though, when you're talking about the opening and how, because, you know, it opens for like 2 minutes, like, because usually when you're watching an older movie like this, it'll have the overture thing. So you'll have a screen that does nothing, but you'll say overture and the music will play. In 2001, it's just a blank screen with this kind of, it is an instrument, but it's kind of a series of sounds. Like, it's kind of like you're in nothingness and all you're hearing are these kind of buzzing kind of noises around you. And then a few nights ago, or maybe it was last night, I just got into my head that I really wanted to watch Boogie Nights again, because sometimes you just get in the mood to watch Boogie Nights.
I understand, yeah.
Has the exact same opening, like just a blank screen where it is playing this kind of very airy music. Like it's not doing anything. And then all of a sudden it bursts into that dun-da-da-da, and then the just camera just starts panning like crazy over the friggin' Boogie Night sign, which is not 2001, but it's just that opening of, yeah, I'm going to make you stare at nothing, which is these uncomfortable sounds, and you're just kind of on edge already. And then Kubrick throws you into this strange land with these apes, and where one actually gets attacked by a leopard. I had to read, because I keep forgetting about that moment. I have to always rewind and go, was that guy in that suit actually attacked by a, oh my God, he's attacked by a leopard. What? Kubrick, what are you doing to these poor people?
It's like, oh, he killed that man, right, yeah.
How many people died on this on the set? And it's kind of that thing. Again, you get this really unsettling before time. It's, and then all of a sudden, the birth of humanity is when we pick up the bone and realize that we can create a tool, and that tool can be to our benefit because we are going to create war, essentially. The violence. We are this kind of inherent violent nature. And it kind of gets picked up through the rest of the film, but it kind of goes in other directions because it's like an orchestra thing in four parts. Like the first part is the dawn of man. Second is just travel, or not even exploration. It's just because they're traveling to the moon, aren't they? And it's
right,
not,
yes.
Or a space station. So it's just literally, I'm going on to business, or I'm going for pleasure. It's just space. It's like plane travel, space travel. The third act is exploration because they're going to Jupiter, and that's when you get Hal. And then the I kind of read the fourth part, which is the last 20 minutes, is sort of more, okay, well, we've colonized it. We've gone as far as we can go. So we're now sitting in a polite, baroque room, being all civilized, I guess, in quotation marks, kind of thing. And it was just sort of interesting how, I guess we'll just jump to the end before we get into the meat of the thing, which is Hal. But what do you think is the ending? What is the ending for you?
Well, I feel like I cheated because I feel like I watched some videos and read some things. And that's why I was saying Kubrick kind of just said it at one point, even though he was usually very like kind of coy about it. But he says that they call, I guess, the Stargate sequence, which is pretty incredible. That's a time when it goes on for a long time, and I'm okay with it because I feel like It just, I feel like it just needs to go on that long. Like he's really going on some kind of journey. And Kubrick said that he's going on like a journey beyond like time and space into like another dimension. And basically what I gather is going on and is that, because that sequence is a real like head scratcher if you don't know what the hell's happening. So he flies through all this crazy stuff that's the stuff that if you were really high, that would probably be like, whoa, man, you know, like.
See, they needed to start with that because I would have loved that. But no, I saw spinning spaceships and I got there as a lullaby and I went to sleep.
It takes long to get there, and then you get there, and it's like, so I think it's a truly incredible sequence. I think it looks really cool. And he goes through this, you feel like he's traveling for a very, very long time, and he ends up in this very strange, almost like a, you know, I don't know, 17th or 18th century French fancy room. It's so quiet. I mean, that's the thing. Sorry, I keep going all over the place, but it's like, I think I read that for a 2.5 hour movie, there's less than like 40 minutes of actual dialogue. So the last line of dialogue's already been spoken before this whole, there's no dialogue at this point. So it's all just music and sounds. And he ends up in this room after he's traveled. And basically it seems like a kind of almost like a zoo that the aliens have created, whoever these beings are who's at the monolith.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like they've been kind of like they leave him there and he gets older. And it's so I do love the way that he shoots the getting older, because like he'll be in one room and like look over and see himself as an old man. And then he'll kind of go to that old man. He'll look over and see himself as an even older man. And so he's like seeing himself age very quickly, it feels like, because I imagine that time is just kind of, I don't know, passing by very quickly or, you know, so and they're just kind of observing him. And then he's a very, very old man, like in the bed, and there's a monolith appears in the room, and he kind of reaches out to it, like the famous painting of who's reaching out to God in that painting, like the Michelangelo, you know, the fingers touching. Yeah. So it's kind of like that, where it's like, you know, he's reaching out to this thing, and then he's like reborn as this, I forgot what they called it, like a star child, like super being or something. And so he's kind of like reincarnated as like this new evolution of this next step of humanity or something. Because the last shot is also very famous of like this baby in this kind of bubble, or, you know, it's like, and floating through space to Earth again. And like, I think I read this, like, oh, this is not my original idea, but I don't want to think I'm like super smart that I came up with this. I read this all somewhere. So it's like that him floating back to Earth is like, he's the next evolution for humanity, and like he can bring about better things to humans and things like that. That he's kind of been chosen as like, you've been reincarnated as this super being, like go help Earth do, you know, the next step on their evolution, basically, is how I take the ending. So it's kind of like a very hopeful ending in a way that there's just like this next step for humanity to hopefully become more enlightened, you know? So that's basically how I take that last 20 minutes. I feel like I just talked a lot, but
it makes sense. Cause I sort of didn't read that. I read a bit about the monoliths, cause I was like, hey, what the hell are the monoliths? And then I read, I'm like, oh, okay. Cause Clark had this whole big idea of what the monoliths actually mean and who was, these aliens were actually presenting them as gifts to Earth to see what they would do with them and all that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, of course that makes sense. Cause I did not get any of that. But this time around, because I knew about the monoliths, I kind of read that as all very symbolic. Like he's reached to the point of past time. There's nowhere else to go. And it's kind of like when human beings, colonization, when you go to a country, you conquer it. And then with all this violence and all this kind of genocide and everything else that goes with it. But then all of a sudden at the end, you are polite society. You're living in this house. All you can do is kind of wait out because there's nothing else to do, if that makes sense. Kind of like Ragnarok with, you know, Anthony Hopkins actually conquering and committing genocide and all these things with the god of death, and all of a sudden all that's left is Ragnarok. And the star baby was literally him being reborn again so humanity could start again. But your way makes much a little bit more sense.
I hope so.
Like it's an actual kind of story thing. I was just like reading into it going, but what if it's this?
Which it's all open to. I mean, I think for a while, I don't know what I had thought. I think I thought like that he had, like he passed through to like the end of time and was like, he had died or something and was just kind of in this weird limbo and then got reborn as this. I don't know if I even thought he was the baby. It's all very weird and confusing. But I mean, you can, it's open to all these interpretations. I'm sure there's plenty of other ones out there. So it's a Kubrick movie. So of course people probably have like thousands and or hundreds of theories about what's going on. So I mean, it's interesting for that way. Like it's more fun for me to talk about this movie than to sit down and watch this movie.
No, it is, because I think when you first kind of watch it, and if you're not sort of, because I mean, the visuals are spectacular, but I think, yeah, like you, I don't necessarily always have the patience for what is happening, even though I love a stylish movie. You show me a movie that's nothing but style and I will go, oh, hello, movie, my new best friend. But this one, I get a little bit, I think it's on purpose. I think Kubrick was trying to make something as ambiguous as possible. So you would have to look at this thing, concentrate on this thing and go, okay, what does this thing actually mean? Because all the parts don't feel like they connect to each other, except for the monoliths. And I think that was kind of the key, because every time he adapted a book, like say The Shining, he stretched it beyond the bounds of the narrative, which I know pisses off some Stephen King fans when they say, The Shining isn't an adaptation of the Stephen King's book, which I would argue it is, because he's just taking some kernels of ideas and then doing something else, which that's what I think an adaptation is. And I think this is kind of similar. He's taken this idea and just kind of stretched it to out of these narrative bounds, and all you have is this movie where you're having to watch it, having to go, right, yeah, the visuals are amazing. They are groundbreaking and they are a blueprint to how other movies are made now. It's like watching the Interstellar when it's the docking scene. Is it when Matt Damon is trying to get on the ship in Interstellar?
I'm trying to remember, because like I really did only see it that one time when I was on cold medicine. So I'm trying to.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember as well.
I'm trying to think.
There's this docking scene in Interstellar that I swear, yeah, you're right, it's almost out of 2001. And I think a lot of filmmakers took 2001 as this blueprint of like, oh, this is how we shoot space. Okay, cool, thank you. You gave us every single little detail. So we knew how to do a docking scene. Now we know how, and this is before they even landed on the moon. So this is really new technology they're actually dealing with. Yeah, thank you. We can do this, this, and this now. I appreciate this. Thank you. And now we shoot space in this way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't speak for, I haven't seen every movie pre-1968, but I feel like no movie had looked like this before this time. Like, had, you know, the effects are so amazing. I can believe why people have that conspiracy theory that Kubrick filmed the moon landing, because this looks so incredible. That, you know, it's like it could be very believable that he could film that and it would look, you know, real. But I don't believe that necessarily. But I can see people would think that. I mean, this looks so good for 68 that it's like, yeah, of course he could have just faked the moon landing. It would look great. So.
Oh, yeah, because he's dealing with technology at a time that was still very, very new. You know, the how to do all these kind of space kind of things. So, yeah, you're right. Though I still subscribe to the theory that Kubrick was, in fact, a professional and did, in fact, go to the moon to shoot the moon landing. Because, you know, it's Stanley Kubrick. He doesn't do anything by half. And he made, you know, poor Armstrong do that moon landing 50 times before he lost his mind and lost his hair and had to, yeah. It's an incredible feat, but yeah, you just have to, I think it's the whole point. He doesn't want you to watch this movie and get it. He wants you to be confused by it, which I think is where my initial irritation came from, because I'm like, don't confuse me. Just tell me what you want me to know and then be ambiguous when you want me to figure this other thing out, but don't just kind of go, huh? Do you get it? Huh? Do you get it? Just leave me alone. Now let me watch the movie.
Just leave me alone. That's a good, just like, stop it. Yeah. I get kind of annoyed with that too sometimes when it's like, I appreciate when someone like leaves things up to the audience interpretation, doesn't give easy answers. Like David Lynch, famous for that. There's something where there's a great quote or a clip where someone's like, they ask about Eraserhead. It's like, do you care to elaborate on that? And he goes, no, I don't. Like, he's like, he just will not elaborate on anything in the movie. He just like completely leaves it open. It's all up to you. And you know what's funny? I was thinking about this too, which is one that it's like, because people always say that he's so like cold and clinical, and like there are movies of his that feel cold later on, but they all have a very human element to them. Yes. Like Eyes Wide Shut is all about like a marriage and cheating, and it's very sexual, obviously. And then like Full Metal Jacket, and has all these great drama with these guys and going to boot camp and going to war, and they've all got some kind of Shine's all about a family. Like it's all they all have this like human element, but like I really feel like 2001, that's the hard thing. It makes it, this is like the one that's truly cold to me, because it makes it very hard to connect on any level besides watching it of a technical level. And it's like I said, I feel like the best performance is given by the voice of Hal, who I guess we should talk about a little bit, because he's the thing that's been like parodied and done. Oh, I was, to bring it back to Disney for a second, there's a, there was a show called Recess back in the day. Great cartoon show, very funny, I think kind of still holds up, but they did, they, I remember they did a parody of Hal, like in the school, like there was like a thing running the school, and you know, it even sings the song, and it looks just like it, like, and so Hal's been like parodied all this stuff, and so the Hal stuff is still fantastic. I mean, I still love the, I love how genius it is too, when they, I'm blanking their names, two guys are in the pod trying to have a private conversation, and you realize that Hal is like reading their lips, I think, is a, and they're trying to plot against him, and that's when he really like turns on them, because he knows that they are trying to kind of get around him, and he's like, can't have any of that.
And then it goes into intermission, which I loved. Just the moment of just silence, and then it's like intermission, blank screen again. I'm like, oh, okay, Kubrick, well done. That was ballsy. Before we really get into how, do you, to go back to your point of 2001 being very cold and lacking any humanity, which I think it does, absolutely. Is it, do you think that that's why Hal has kind of stuck in pop culture? Because he's kind of the element that people remember, they, as you said, they parody. Do you think it's because that's, of how he filmed it and why? And it, because it is kind of the more electric plot point in a way. Do you think that's why Hal has, is the one that sort of stands the test of time within 2001?
Yeah, because he just is so iconic in the way that, Kubrick shoots that kind of like red eye, you know, basically. And the voice is so cold and like kind of easy to mimic. Like, what are you doing, David? You know, the whole way. And it's the only like true villain in the movie. That's when the movie kind of becomes like a normal structured movie with like, okay, now we have our villain that's trying to hurt our protagonist, even though I don't think we are that attached to the protagonist. Like, is it Keir Dalia?
Keir Dalia. That's how I say it, but I could be wrong.
Like, yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, he's fine. I mean, he's not asked to do very much, honestly. I do love the scene. It's a very famous scene, too, where he's telling how to open the pod bay doors, and the way that Kubrick shoots it with the light on his face, and that's really stood out to people. But I think, yeah, that's probably Hal, because he's the villain. So you finally have like a normally kind of structured movie for about a little bit there, where it's like, okay, we know our protagonist, and he's trying to get around Hal, who's become a bad guy now, and is trying to stop them from you know, doing anything that goes off the mission. And oh, someone pointed this out, and I had never caught this. Is super subtle. I never caught this before. That when Hal is playing chess with I'm blanking, the other guy, but it's like a quick scene. They're playing chess, and he tries to make a move, or he's like, did you see that? And he's like, no. And then like apparently the thing that Hal tells him is not right. Like basically Hal cheats, and the guy doesn't catch it, and people think that's the moment where Hal is like, I'm really going to take over this mission, because these guys aren't smart enough. Yeah, because Kubrick was like a big, big chess guy, which I heard before. Like, he loved chess. So there's no way that he would get a chess move wrong, basically, is what they're saying. Unintentional, or, you know. So they think it's intentional that Hal, like, says the move. It's an illegal move or something. So that Hal, like, is testing him a little bit, and the guy doesn't catch it. So he's like, aha, you guys aren't smart enough to do this. I'll take over. Which is another little interesting kind of nugget in the movie of, you know, it's, there are layers here that make it more interesting to go, again, more interesting to think about and dissect afterwards than to be in the moment, because there's just so much time of like watching things happen, which I, even if like I think, oh, that's really cool and well done, I don't need to look at it for like 5 or 10 minutes, you know, like in a row. I'm like, I got it. So that's why I feel bad saying bad things about this movie, but because it's a classic. But I, like I said at the beginning, I'm like, there's not a bigger gap between this movie is amazing and I respect it, and like I don't really have that much fun watching it.
No, because I think it probably shows you how good a filmmaker Kubrick actually was, because usually the thing, okay, so the rule of making art is you need to know the rules before you can break them. And I think this movie is that, just before I get into my whole passive aggressive howl thing. it's kind of this thing where when most filmmakers are showing you everything, it's because they're padding, either they're doing a thing like Kubrick is, or they're padding out their movie. Like they don't have enough footage to cut out a guy walking across a car park. If like I know, Matt, you've seen a lot of schlocky B-grade Vinegar Syndrome-esque kind of movies, so you know what I'm talking about when you're watching the whole thing and you're just like going, what, you couldn't have cut? Oh, it's because you need this movie to be 120 minutes. You need this to be 80 minutes long. Okay, so we're going to see the girl undress completely, like without cut, which does not make it sexy because you're just watching someone undress, unless someone else is making that movie and they've taken enough footage where they can cut and quicken it up a little bit. And this is the kind of stuff that Kubrick's doing, but he's doing it on purpose and to a specific effect. That maybe by the time you get to hell, that you are in a specific mindset because you've just sat for an hour and a half watching all these very particular things, you know, very meticulously how humans beings have made these ships, how they've put them together, and then you meet Hal, who, by the way, is the most passive-aggressive computer AI I've ever come across. I mean, just the way he says, oh, well, I'm sorry, Dave, I don't think I can do that. Or, you should take a stress pill. I'm like, did you tell him to take a chill pill? Oh, my God. but yeah, because I was going to ask you, because they missed the chess. I didn't even catch the chess move, and I didn't. And I apparently 2010 does explain why Hal goes completely mental, but I have not seen 2010 yet.
I have not either, and I've actually heard it's people think it's kind of good. I feel like for years it was like one of those things. It's like, why do they make a sequel to 2001? It's a classic, and I feel like the tide has turned to be like 2010 is pretty good. Like I don't think anyone says it's as good, but they think it's like, it's worth watching. I kind of need to see it now. I think it does explain some things in that movie, too.
Yeah, because it's Peter Hyams, I think, who directed it.
Right,
so,
he's a good director, too.
He's a really good director. So so that apparently explains more about Hal. But when you're just watching 2001 on the face of it, the big thing is that he tells them that some antenna or something is going to malfunction. So they go out and fix it and find out nothing's wrong with it. And that's where the issue starts, because they don't know whether he's lying or whether he made a mistake. And Hal One doesn't make mistakes. So that, so it's this kind of thing. Do you think he made a mistake, or do you think he was lying to start this whole kind of thing of, I need to take over the mission?
Now that I know the chess thing, which I never heard before, and like, I didn't catch that. I had to read about it. So I'm not, again, I don't know that much, but I do think, that he, it's all kind of him just manipulating them to a certain point. I don't think he's making a mistake either. I think he's just lying and trying to take the whole thing over.
Yeah, because I thought he had made a mistake, and the whole thing, when I was just sort of watching it, not realizing the chess move, all that kind of thing, I was like, oh, did Hal screw up? Because he's been bragging, oh, I don't make mistakes. And is it because he's just been hanging around these humans who are infallible, who do who are kind of lazy? They more, you know, watch birthday messages from their family. They talk to her, do interviews. They, it's this kind of weird thing that he's kind of just taken up all this humanity, like Pat did when she got all the stuff downloaded, is that she got confused and that kind of thing. And then once they realized, oh, he made a mistake, he's like, oh, I need to cover my tracks. This is bad. Oopsie doodle. This is a big oopsie doodle. so, you know, one thing led to another, and I just let a guy fly through space, but you know, it's fine. I thought it was that. Which I think that interpretation still could work, because I think there's an interesting point about Hal becoming infallible, that he makes mistakes, that he tries to do all these stupid human things that don't necessarily work out. But at the same time, him becoming smarter than everyone else and manipulating the whole situation is also a brilliant way to watch this movie, because that makes him more evil, I think, that he's just, he's taking, because a lot of great villains are taking things to their logical conclusion, but that means that a whole bunch of bad shit's about to happen, and that's what Hal's doing.
I he's the most interesting thing in the movie. I mean, like, the most interesting character, I guess you could say, as a character, because you're not sure how he's playing it for a while, like, what he's up to. Like, yes, he's passive aggressive, which I just find funny.
That's my favorite bit. I'm like, Hal is a passive aggressive. Oh my God, he would drive me nuts. It's just...
And I'm just thinking about this, that it's like, I've called this movie very cold and like not, but for a movie all about like humanity and her evolution, it feels so cold and not human, if that makes sense. And so I feel bad. Like, I don't know. It's just interesting. Like, and the Hal thing, of course, there's another layer about like, and this has been a constant theme in movies for forever now, about like humans versus machines or AI. And like, do we give them so much power that they can like destroy us, you know, like, that's a little dangerous. And how they could turn against us, like Skynet and Terminator, obviously, and, you know, the Matrix, obviously, the machines turn us into batteries. Like, there's all these things. So that's still an interesting component of the movie. Like, it's funny because I pitched this double to you as almost like kind of like, haha, that'd be funny. And then it dawned on me that we'd have to talk about 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is a movie that I feel like under normal circumstances I would avoid talking about because it's so big and epic and famous and tough to talk about. And now I'm like in this and I'm like, I don't know how much else I could say about it. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? I feel like it's just tough to talk about, honestly, where I was like, this will be funny, Smart House. And I was like, oh no, now I've talked about 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then I went, oh shit, I have to watch 2001. Crap.
It's daunting. It's very daunting.
It's daunting. It's a daunting movie to watch. And I think this is kind of one of those movies that I have, and I would say Lynch is actually in this as well, where I have a very weird relationship with those directors because I think they're too intelligent for me. So I don't tend to want to watch their movies. And every time I do, I find usually something I can go, oh, okay. Yep, Jack Nicholson's got weird eyebrows. I can go with The Shining. There's a great line in Doctor Strangelove where it finally clicked to me because I was thinking, oh, I don't think I love Doctor Strangelove. And then President Mufflin, after they've set the nukes on heading toward Russia, he's talking to the Russian president and who's like going, oh, God, this is terrible. This is going to be, you know, well, they're going to be annihilated. And he goes, you feel bad. How do you think I feel? And I went, ah, yep, nope, I've got this movie that – there's a little thing. And 2001 has, well, I think it's Hal, actually, if I'm to be honest. That is that wrinkle of like, oh, okay, I think I get this character of this robot who's either fucking with these guys or is trying to cover up a mistake. Probably more he's trying to control these guys more than anything else. But it's, yeah, it's fascinating that Kubrick made a movie, wanted to see if he could make a movie where he thought, oh, if I don't give the audience to grab a hold of something, how are they going to respond to it? Because I know in 1968, this movie confused the hell out of people.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you reminded me of this. My favorite story about like the early screenings of this, and I don't know if you read this or not, there was like a big, something like a big premiere, probably in Hollywood, I'd imagine, with hundreds of people, press and famous stars were there, and lots of walkouts.
Oh, yeah.
And my favorite walkout was apparently Rock Hudson reportedly got up and walked down the aisles and was just like yelling, like, can someone tell me what the hell this movie's about? Which I imagine was a lot of people in 1968 watching, like, can someone tell me what the hell this is all about?
I can just imagine you sitting there because there is a particular way movies are made. I mean, yes, you're getting into the late 60s, so things are very much changing, very becoming very artistic, very becoming very director controlled. But then you watch this thing and it's 2.5 hours long and you feel every single minute of this movie. I can imagine, imagine just people getting up and walking out like this. and it's an interesting experience being in a movie with people walking out because every year there's fingers crossed it goes through this year, the Melbourne International Film Festival, where we just get like hundreds of movies being played in various venues for 2 to 3 weeks. And it's incredible if you just go see movie after movie after movie. And then you'll see these really weird international ones. Like I was watching this, I can't remember what it was called. It was nearly 3 hours long, and it was an exercise in boredom. Like, this movie didn't cut. It just panned really slowly to different points. It was just hit people conversations, this poor, very poor village where these people lived, and they didn't really... The whole thing is, like, there's nothing to do. So it doesn't really get violent at the end, but you're just panning. And the amount of walkouts of literally the same reaction, like, what the fuck is this movie? And I'm like, no, this guy is trying to bore you. I seriously think he's just going, you know what? You want to know what it's like to be in a tiny, poor village where there's nothing to do? I'm going to give you a movie where there's nothing to do. And I think Kubrick had the same idea in mind, if he could just... go, no, if you just focus on the visuals, if you narrow in on it, and everyone's just like going, what?
Yeah, and this is why I'm sure there's like many, many smarter people who could talk about this movie in different ways and probably think I'm stupid. But I feel like the scenes where Kubrick is just showing us like a spaceship dock or a platform go down, I don't know what he's wanting me to look at besides just look at these effects that we made. I'm like, that's cool, but it's like I don't need to see it uninterrupted for like 5 straight minutes. Like that's the thing that I think I struggle with the movie. It's like where I don't see any reason of like a narrative or any kind of like deeper meaning of like, why am I looking at a spaceship dock? Why am I watching a platform go down? You know, there's no like weirdness there, or it is what it is. I don't think there's any kind of like other meaning. Like a David Lynch movie, he might show you some weird image for a few minutes, but like you don't know why he's doing it, and you're like,
oh, he's cutting in the middle of it, so there's a pace to it.
And there's a pace. Yeah, it's like he's cutting. Like I can think of, there's so many great weird moments in like Lynch movies where you're like, why did that happen? Why is there a scary person behind a dumpster in Mulholland Drive? Why is a cowboy showing up for no reason? Like, you know, but this is like, I'm just watching a spaceship dock, or I'm watching a platform go down. I don't know what else he wants me to see from it. I can't imagine any deeper meaning to what I just imagine he's like showing off the effects, which is understandable for 1968. Like, I get it. It's very impressive, but it's like someone wanting you to look at their, you know, coin collection, and you're like, it's very nice. I don't know what else to say about it. Like, congrats on getting these. They mean a lot to you. But it's like, to me, I'm not, you know, I'm not get. And once you've seen it once, it's the weird stuff you can go back to and go, okay, maybe this time I think it means this or it means that. Like, I can't go back to this one and go, oh, maybe this time the platform descending is the descent of man into madness. Or, so, you know, I can't, like, there's no deeper intellectual meaning I can get from that. So that's why I think it doesn't hold up for me to watch it over and over. And like I said, unless I see it on like some big screen or an IMAX or some, you know, really cool screening, I don't know if I'd go back to some one again. But Smart House, I think I will watch more.
Oh, no. Smart House is deeply watchable. And you don't get the sense that LeVar Burton is like going, I'm going to make you sit here for 10 minutes and watch this one thing because I can.
People are so mad at me right now, I'm sure.
No, I think I was a bit worried. I'm like, oh, people are not going to like my point of view on 2001. Yes, it is a genius movie. Kubrick was a genius. I'm not denying that. I'm just saying 2001's a pain in the ass occasionally. Because I've just, the sense is Kubrick is like, I'm the master, therefore you will watch anything that I give you. Which I think there's a few Kubricks I need to see, but there's that kind of, and usually he is bang on in his choices, but there's sometimes an element of, I'm the master, you will watch anything I give you. And then I'm suddenly going, but what if I don't want to watch what you give me? Can I get a choice in that?
And
I've never had that with any other director, because there's directors I have love-hate relationships with, but I can kind of go, well, okay, Michael Bay, sorry, it's a dumb example, but I can go, yes, there are many things I hate about Armageddon, but I still cry at the end. I don't know why. But this, I have a love-hate relationship with him, but I can kind of relate to the style that he's doing, because he is, again, very much about style, and he's just going to tell that story in this particular way and have some really bizarre sexist comment that didn't need to be in there, but it's in there. And I'm just like focusing on that. And then, oh, now we're in another Transformers car fight. Okay, whatever. And then kind of go back and forth, but I can kind of accept it because it's Bay. Kubrick, I'm kind of like going, but why? Because you keep asking me questions of these deep, meaningful questions about humanity, where we come from, Hal, you know, what is human? And then all of a sudden it's this other thing. And I'm like going, so why are you showing me this? I'm just can't, he's expecting you to question certain things, but not question others. And I think that's where I get very frustrated with him. And especially with 2001.
Yeah, it's probably at its height in 2001. Because like I said, I would rather watch many, many other Kubrick movies ahead of this one. And like compared to something like Eyes Wide Shut, which is a movie that I didn't understand the first time at all. I was still pretty young. And that was just like one of those movies where it's like, it came out, it was such a sensation. It was like, oh, Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, it's sexy. And, you know, it's like, everyone's like, I got to see the sexy movie. And then it's like, it's really weird. And it's like, but I think there's more to go back to and mine from Eyes Wide Shut, because there's so many weird parts. And it goes back to like more of a human element, like the performances, about this marriage kind of going through this weird thing. And it's like, is it, people are like, is it a dream? Is it not? It's like, there's all these weird little moments that Tom Cruise has on this crazy night where you can go back to and kind of interpret it different ways. And I feel like I get so much more out of that movie every time I watch it. And I think it's so interesting. So it's like the opposite of 2001, where it's like, I go watch that and there's so much more to gather because there's so many weird little touches in that movie and so many weird scenes where you're like, well, what was that supposed to be about? Or like, does this mean, is it a dream? Is it not? What's going on? You know? I don't know. I don't know what else I'm trying to say, but
I get what you're trying to say, because I couldn't help thinking of something like Clockwork Orange, which is a movie that makes you sit in this horrific violence, but it's funny because a woman gets knocked on her head by a giant penis, or there's this horrific rape scene, but he's singing in the rain, or singing in the rape, I think it is. It's like really disgusting, but there's this kind of like watching this gang rape scene, but it's done like a ballet. These kind of twisting these very violent scenes so you don't know what to think about them. And he's making you ask, okay, so how do you take violence in this context? How do you take violence in this context? And he does this a little bit in 2001, but not enough because he's doing so many other things. And it feels like he's the height of his powers. He can apparently in his mind do no wrong. And he's so meticulous that you're just sitting there going, okay, yep, why am I still here? Okay, but because you say so. Okay, fine, whatever. And yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with 2001, if that makes sense. Kind of similar where you are by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it sounds like we're in the same place with this movie. Like,
yeah.
I would never argue it's not like an amazing masterpiece, technical achievement. I just don't really enjoy watching it. You know, it's kind of like, it's like seeing, you know, this great thing and I kind of nod and go, oh, wow, that's really cool. Impressive. Yeah. But I'm like, I'm left very cold from the whole thing. So that's kind of the difference. So
It absolutely is. And with that, I guess the credits will close because we could probably talk about 2001 for another 3 hours, but it, like 2001, we'll be going around in circles. which is very 2001. Thank you so much for coming on with this double. It was, I loved it actually. Just because I knew, watching it, I was going to be able to talk about it. So I kind of paid different attention to a movie that I thought I never was going to watch again. And it gave me new appreciation for it, even though it still frustrates me, if that makes sense.
No, I'm kind of in the same place, I feel like, where, yeah, it's like, and thanks for letting me do this crazy double, because I pitched this to you, and I'm like, this is an insane idea, but you allowed me to do it. And I will say, I am proud that, again, because this is the second time in a row, I think I've really hit at the theme of the show, which is the schlock and the awe coming together, because I did Mac and Me and E.T.
Yes.
And I did this, which is like a Disney Channel original and Stanley Kubrick classic, and I'm like, I'm really getting at the heart of the show, which I like to do. I'm like, I love your doubles. Every episode is great, but most of the time it's like a double that makes sense. And I think most of the time they're on equal footing. Not this time. This is a very different level of quality, even though I have more fun with Smart House.
No, the thing is, with E.T. and Mac and Me, I love E.T. just because of 5,000 different reasons, which if you go back to listen to the show, I tell about 5 different times. and Mac and Me was such a surprise because I was like, what? How did someone give money for them to, oh, McDonald's did. What? So I was just screaming at the television going, what are you doing? What the hell is happening? And with Smart House, it was kind of a delightful surprise because if one thing Disney knows how to do, it's how to make a movie for its target audience. It's like,
that's true.
That's what Disney does. I mean, it just goes, oh, this is the audience that wants this, we'll give them that. And if you're 14 to, you know, a teenager watching Smart House in 1999, you're like, yeah, this is a great movie. This is everything I want. Even because I really want a floor that just eats everything. But 2001, Kubrick is giving you a movie that you don't want. It, but it's going to stick with you in your brain. Like, I've been thinking about 2001 since I saw it last, and I did for the last two times as well. And I'm not entirely sure how I feel about that, but he does make movies that linger with you. They are not just sort of one-time experiences. They kind of take up rent space in your brain, and you just have to process them. I don't necessarily think Smart House is a schlocky movie, but it is a movie for its intended audience, even if they play five in it, which again, actually for their intended audience. I mean, it's 1999. But I do think you do get to the heart of the double. I do try to mix it up a little bit, but yeah, it's, and I think the schlock and the awe depends on the context of the double, but you just come in swinging with these amazing kind of, holy shit, we're doing this. And it's usually so much fun to talk about. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. No, it's always fun. I'll have to come back sooner than last time. It's been too long. So, because
definitely.
Yeah, this was fun. And I will say, I think I said this before on podcast or not, but the E.T. Mac and Me episode was like one of my favorite podcasts I've recorded on any show. I just thought it was like so much fun. And I appreciate E.T. in a whole new way. I liked how we talked about Spielberg a whole bunch in a way. Like, I feel like I appreciate him in a whole new.
Yes.
In a whole new way. So I really had a good time that episode. So I'm going to try to think of something for next time that we'll see if I can do this again with a real. Real schlocky, real awe-inspiring double feature.
Exactly, because you realize the miracle that E.T. is when you compare it to Mac and Me. Though I will say, had so much fun with Mac and Me. That is not a disparage. I would watch that movie.
Fun,
oh
bad
God,
movie.
I've watched like, that movie again.
Oh my God, yeah, it's very fun. It's completely insane, but it's a very entertaining movie.
So please tell the people where they can find you, Matt, so they can listen to more of your good work.
Yes. So Film Feast podcast, please go like, subscribe to us, all that kind of stuff. Anywhere you can get podcasts, just search for Film Feast and you should find us. And you could follow me on Twitter at MattBled87. You could follow my podcast on Twitter at Film Feast Pod. And you can follow me and the podcast on Instagram, which is Film Feast, which is all one word. We're doing all kinds of stuff all the time. I feel like my show's a very hard sell because it doesn't have a gimmick. It's like just a movie podcast. Like, I'm very jealous of like you guys who are like, here's my podcast. We do this, we do that. I'm like, we just talk about movies. So, I mean, it's good because it really opens everything. I can do anything, but
you can. Also, I was about to say, but you can do anything.
it's a hard quick sell, but it's just like, you know, we did like Legend with Carmelita, the Ridley Scott Legend. We did the Jackass movies, which I thought was like going to be impossible to talk about, but I had Mitch on there, and
that was such a good episode. Oh my God, the flashbacks I had to 2002. I was just like,
when Mitch pitched to me doing the Jackass movies, I was like, but how? I was like, how do we, there's such visual, it's gags and pranks. And, but it was more a conversation about like growing up in the early 2000s. And it was still, it was a very fun episode. I thought it turned out really well. And then like, you know, we've done all kinds of stuff. So I just love that every week, I don't even know what it's going to be. So it's a lot of fun for me to do too. So.
No, you've done some amazing work, especially with the Carmelita, the Mitch episode with the Jackass. Cause I was never a Jackass. I was just would watch it and go, why? But now I want to go back and watch them. So I need to get onto that and just actually try and experience it and kind of relive my stupid early 20s. But no, I mean, you've done amazing ones on Ed Wood. You've done these amazing, kind of your movie swaps of the best things that you've done with Anthony and Daniel. It is such a great show. And I think everyone, if you haven't, please listen, please subscribe, because it is an amazing show and you do amazing work.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
If you want to subscribe and rate and do all that thing for Schlock and Awe, please do. We are found on all podcast apps. I think you can find us or find me there. I'm saying us, but it's just me. Find me there. Yep, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Schlock and Awe 1. And if you want to follow just me, I'm at Reading Geek on Twitter. Again, thank you so much for coming on. This was an absolute blast to do.
Oh, well, thank you for having me back. This was a ton of fun, and I can't wait to come back in with some other crazy double that I pitched to you.
Yes.
So, thanks for me talking about Smart House, because I don't know when I could talk about Smart House on a podcast, so this has been fun.
That's the beauty of movie podcasts. You can go, hang on, I want to talk about this movie, and you can go, wait, I have a podcast, or I know someone who I can talk about this movie with, and you're like, yes. So that's the beauty of it, I think. And so, yes, thank you for coming on. We'll be back with another double next time on Shock and Awe. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.